Welcome to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, hosting this series on the institutions created for international cooperation in monetary and economic affairs, starting at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. We are currently looking at the institutions created for international cooperation and economic development, starting with the World Bank. We began with a deep dive into the operations of the World Bank, how it is funded and makes loans. In the second podcast, we looked at the other members of the World Bank group, IDA, the IFC, MIGA, and ICSID, as well as the use of trust funds administered by the World Bank. In our third chapter, we'll explore the World Bank's role as a knowledge bank and the importance of that role in economic development. We'll also look at the World Bank's relations with its sister institution, the IMF, and at the bank's increasing role in helping its members deal with the economic development challenges and opportunities of climate change. My expert guest is once again Joachim Levy, former chief financial officer of the World Bank, finance minister of Brazil, and president of the Brazilian Development Fund. Thank you for giving us the benefit of your practical insights and deep experience in economic development and the World Bank. The World Bank is now often referred to as a knowledge bank, reflecting the importance of that expertise and training it provides to countries for economic development. We discussed in the prior podcast that effective government institutions and well-functioning markets, financial markets, and business markets are key to economic development, whether we're speaking of lower-income countries or advanced economies for that matter. How does the group engage in this capacity building through its technical assistance and through its financing?
Yeah, I think that it's a knowledge bank in both ways. They have the best people in many fields. These people can engage with the local authorities, and these often creates capacity. And it goes both ways, because also the people you know more about the local issues, the specificities, and then when you exchange experience with the bank staff, I think there's a mutual learning process. The bank also, a bit like the IMF too, they can even have some sort of academies for officials in the country. So it's also knowledge in the sense, like you mentioned, capacity building in the country. There are many instances where, for instance, the bank will put in place things that will improve process, we reform processes. It could be on health, how you train the nurses, how you give the incentives, how you reward, how you ensure that they have what they need, and all of that. It very often happens in the administration. How the money is used, how you set up the budgets, how you follow the money, how you put, for instance, ERPs in countries so that you can have all the compliance embedded in the process. And in all of this is also very important because, you see, misuse or waste of money is one of the worst things that can happen in the public sector. And, of course, creates room for corruption, and corruption is extremely destructive. But more generally, just wasting money and not having, sometimes the computers or the systems to ensure that everything is tracked and then you know what's going on is detrimental. So the bank also has a number of programs that are related to this type of capacity building, not only the delivery of the final service, but also to ensure that resources are used in the right way. And also, without extending too much about corruption, and of course, the bank has changed the way it talks about this. But another thing that the bank does that deals with this is freeing companies. I mean, reducing the political ties of of companies in the private sector, increasing competition, fostering competition, opening economies, is all of this is so important to ensure a growth, to ensure development. So I think that the IFC and through a number of programs of IDA, it's not only improving the way government works itself, but also the way the private sector works, giving more freedom, more independence, sometimes independence even to fund itself, doesn't depend so much from government institutions. All of these can help the economy to work better, to generate wealth to people, income, to improve the income distribution.
Yeah. Well, the structure of the private sector and how it works, and also the effectiveness and efficiency of the government. So that's important knowledge to share. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that knowledge bank role and the challenge of climate change and how you see the bank contributing that way.
No doubt. I mean, as I mentioned, the bank and all these operations that we discussed, the mechanics and the financials behind them, they very often they were innovative. They're the first of doing this, the first of addressing that. And the bank has been in the forefront of what you call environmental, activities and so on, and then climate. For many, many years, protecting the nature and goes hand in hand with protecting people. But the knowledge in terms of climate is something that the bank can contribute a lot to this. And one important thing that the bank can do is to find what are the priorities. If you want to address climate change, if you want to reduce emissions, if you want to reduce the impact of climate change, what are the main things that you have to do? How you pick the priorities? How you can help with that? So the bank can have a crucial role in steering the discussion. How, for instance, you address the coal phasing out, how you help countries to really do this, looking at all the impact that phasing out coal can have in the economy, because for some countries, coal is an important part of the economy. It impacts transportation, impacts industry, the availability of energy, and so on. A lot of jobs. So the bank has certainly a role. The same way with related to agriculture. And here I think that one important focus ought to be adaptation, especially for poorer countries. You know, these poor economies, which are often in tropical areas, they have contributed little or almost nothing to global warming. But they will be the ones suffering most from extreme weather conditions. And these would have impact in their cities, would have impact in agriculture. They can become very vulnerable. And these also can have impact in terms of population movements and so on and so forth. So addressing that can be a huge task for the bank, but one that is, I would say, commensurate to its resources. And it goes not only to build, structures or public works that you protect, towns against the sea level and things like this, but also how you implement crops that are more resilient, how you organize water distribution so that, populations get more resilient, both in the countryside and in cities and so on. That I think that the knowledge that the bank can share and the kind of projects they can do in adaptation, it can make a tremendous difference in the world in the decades ahead. And
yeah.
So
yeah, yeah. No, I mean it's clear that the amount of support in terms of not just financing but in terms of sheer advice on how to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions in a practical way, in a way that doesn't thwart development but helps development, and then to adapt to changing conditions, that there's just a huge amount that the World Bank can do to support.
It's already doing. We can talk about mm-hmm. this later, but it's already doing. There are some very interesting initiatives, some of them together with the IMF too.
Yeah. So talking about the IMF, I thought it would be useful to remind our listeners of some of the ways the World Bank already coordinates a lot of its activities with the IMF. There have been a number of express memoranda of understanding between the managements of the two institutions to kind of define their respective roles, particularly as it comes to advice on economic policy, where there's a certain amount of overlap. Some key areas where the two institutions have worked together and that were discussed in our prior podcasts are in developing the debt sustainability analyses for individual low-income countries and in conducting financial sector assessments, so-called FSAPs, of member countries, and reviews of member country compliance with specific standards and codes set by the international regulatory bodies, these so-called ROSCs. And these are roles that were requested of the two institutions by the G20 and the FSB. I'd also note that both the IMF and the World Bank have senior representatives at the plenary of the FSB and participate ex officio in meetings of the G20. So can you talk a little bit about this cooperation that you've seen from your own experience and how it's important?
Yes, I think that some of the things that you touched it really give a great sense of how the World Bank and the IMF work together. Both in say, poorer countries, you had all the structural ASAPs and the debt forgiveness in the past. But again, for instance, in Central Europe, after the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008, the bank was really fundamental to stabilize the region and indirectly the Eurozone. The Eurozone itself was more the realm of IMF, but around it, the World Bank also helped that. And I mean, if you think in Southeast Asia, the impact of the World Bank in Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines, even in India, has been really very important. And sometimes for some of these countries, it went together with the IMF. So I would say that there is a certain division of work between the two. And of course, the World Bank will look at more structural transformations, while the remit of the IMF often is more to ensure the balance of payment, the payment of creditors, and this kind of things, more financial. But to succeed, they really had to work hand in hand.
Yeah, so in those two large crises, the 2007, 2008, and then in the late 1990s, the Asian crisis, and early 2000s, you really needed all hands on deck, and the IMF and the World Bank were both important pieces of helping to resolve those crises and come out the other end successfully. What about everyday cooperation between the two? How does that go?
Well, it's you see, you remember I mentioned in first part the budget support loans. Often they mm-hmm. complement the loans from IMF, and they are really a way to help the country to go through a crisis at the time they're changing the structure of the economy, and it goes. In Even if you are not in crisis, like you mentioned, for instance, the FSB, the introduction of financial reforms after the 2007 crisis. I mean, you remember that there was an overhauling of the financial architecture. The FSB, the Financial Stability Board, it's a child of the G20. And of course, the World Bank participated, like you mentioned, in some of these stances, because a lot of countries that are member of the World Bank are not in the G20. In the G20, you have basically 20, a little bit more, because you have the Eurozone represented there. But you out of 170 and almost 200 countries that are around the world and a part of the multilaterals, only basically 20 are the G20. So I had the honor, the privilege to be part, to represent the bank at both at the FSB as well as in the G20 annual process of the G20 and being Sherpa in a couple of years. And there, our role is really to see the impact of the changes in regulations, of overall changes in global policies. What will be the effect on the poorer countries? And also bring the needs of these poorer countries to the attention of this, the G20 in particular. So we got involved, for instance, on how you could make some regulations, for instance, in capital requirements for lending to less developed countries, less difficult for these countries. Sometimes you have to put a lot of more capital when you make a loan for infrastructure in certain countries than in others. And this, of course, has an impact on the capital costs. And this type of issue is even more important now with climate change, that we require a lot of investment. And if the capital cost for doing this green investment is very, very high, how can a poor country, even middle-income country, afford this type of investment? So it's a type of the discussion where the World Bank can also have an important role. And I would say that the climate finance is really in the forefront of a lot of discussions. And there is a regulatory aspect, a prudential aspect to it, that has an impact on the capital cost to some of the action needed to address climate change in developed countries that have to be discussed in this forum.
Yeah, now often, you know, the regulations that may have very good intentions have unintended consequences. And so to have people at the table who can give kind of a more macro view of what some of these implications are, it just makes for a better informed decisions. So that's a very important role.
It's very special to be the voice of so many in these places. Yeah.
Well, that's right. Now let's talk a little bit more about, we've been talking a lot about climate, but it is a current important issue. And I think it'd be useful to talk a bit about how the IMF over time has been engaged in environmental concerns and has analyzed environmental impacts of proposed development projects and programs. And they've been doing this since the 1970s. I read a fact that I'm sure will be interesting to you, Joachim, that the first environmental loan the World Bank made, in fact, was made to Brazil to deal with pollution. So Brazil was at the forefront of building World Bank experience in this sector. And you've talked a lot about what can be done with the bank as the knowledge bank. Today, there is a widely recognized enormous gap in the financing that's going to be required to mitigate and adapt to climate change compared to the current official resources available to do so. And for a number of years, the World Bank has been pressed to do more. Can you explain a bit the role the World Bank's expected to play now in mobilizing and administering resources to address those two aspects of climate change?
Well, you're right. The demands in terms of financial demands, in terms of climate change, energy transition, general economic transition, can be very huge. I mean, just moving out of coal to renewable could involve a lot of money, not only because of the plants themselves, but because I mentioned the value chains that are involved, and you have to redeploy people, redesign a little bit the economies and so on. And this may require resources to facilitate this transition. So how much you can mobilize for that is a very a good question. Fortunately, in many cases, the new technology will be more productive. In a way, it will be cheaper than the old production. So, if you can mobilize the resources, if you can address some of the risks associated, you actually can get things that you have a positive net present value, and ultimately we work in favor of the economies. But you have to be aware. You see, for some developing countries, for most of developing countries, there are two issues. One is the expansion of the energy base. And there, I think, is easier to go with renewables. There are situations where you have to think about batteries and other ways to conserve energy, because you know renewables has some intermittencies. But this is more easy to address. There's the other thing, which is the phasing out of existing plants. There, not only you have to think about, how to compensate the investment that has been made, but also the things that go around, the value chains that go around, and there you have to think about a bigger amount of money, because in a few cases you really can get gains in efficiency, but it's a much more complex to do, and of course there are a few instruments that are being developed for these purposes. There are also instruments that are being developed to help countries that, like you mentioned, had very little impact on climate change, but you'll be extremely vulnerable to these changes. So, for instance, we have these loss and damage funds. They are geared exactly to help countries to adapt, sometimes also to get new sources of energy that mitigate emissions. But you'll mostly be a transfer for those countries that have been responsible for most of the emissions so far, towards the countries that will be the most affected by the consequences of these emissions. As you know, carbon.
Yeah,
emissions...
the World Bank. The World Bank's going to be the institution that administers that fund on
exactly.
behalf of the founders of it.
Yes, it's still the loss and damage fund. It's still an incipient structure, but I think it gives a sense of the many ways in which the World Bank, because the trust people have need, will be part of the solutions to the problems, these existential problems.
And can you talk a little bit, and this really relates to sort of, in a way, the knowledge bank part of it. The World Bank has started doing, a couple of years ago, climate and development reports. What are those aimed to do, which I thought they sounded interesting?
No, they're excellent products. They're fundamental product. They are really they're a report, but they also are kind of a white papers on the challenges and the options for countries in addressing climate together with development. There has been a discussion, well, should the World Bank forget about development and focus on climate and this, like you mentioned, the commons and the things that affect the whole world? Well, it quickly became very clear that these things go hand in hand. Of course,
right.
for poor countries, if climate worsen, they will be the most affected. At the same time, the climate can be a source of development for some countries because they also open opportunities. And part of what these reports do for many of these countries is to make clear, look, you can be a source of the minerals for the new economy. You can use your workforce to be part of the new industries that will be necessary for this new global low carbon footprint economies. How you can redesign your agriculture to do that, to both be less vulnerable and also gain with, world that wants to be carbon neutral, etc. So they have done, I think they now had around 60 reports. They presented, I think, 43 reports by the last COP, and they continue to do this. They have done this for relatively large economies like Brazil, but also for small economies. So this creates a knowledge base that's very important. And you know, this is not only for the authorities. Because this is knowledge, sharing knowledge, this becomes a platform also for investors. And this is very important because, you see, often people are stretching their head to think, oh, how I can finance a green energy in country A, B, C, and D. Well, creating these information, these knowledge platforms can really help attracting the investment. Of course, you also have to address the other problems, like we discussed before, political risk, all the other risks that these countries have to attract investments. But by disseminating the knowledge, the potential, the talents of these countries, through the lens of the new economy, is a very important thing and can be very helpful for investors. Of course, in the last couple of years, we've been through a very particular time in terms of how you manage money and capital flows and so on. There's a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty, but ultimately we're going to see new flows of capital to different parts of the globe, okay, especially after inflation is really subdued, and so these documents and all this work of the World Bank together with authorities, together with financial institutions, I think has this work has a tremendous potential to accelerate the investment that is needed to address climate change. It doesn't have to be much more investment, but it has to be a more intelligent investment. So together with some other products, like you mentioned, the FSAP. The FSAP now often includes a part of a climate exposure. How climate exposure creates risk for the financial market. This is very important. And again, addressing these things, putting this part as part of the surveillance work, both by IMF, but also the discussions, the strategy discussions of the World Bank, is really crucial and extremely helpful for both government as well as global investors. And I think it can foster the development of new financial products.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned somewhat already how the IMF and the World Bank are working together. Can you talk a little bit more in specifics on climate change and the two slightly different roles of the institution, since we've talked about the IMF so much in earlier podcasts?
Okay, I don't know if you talked about one initiative that the IMF had, which was this Resilience and Sustainability Facility. Again, this is
we did a little bit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is almost a pilot, but can be very interesting because again, these are facilities really targeted to help countries to act on things that are climate related. It can be very different type of activities, okay, but they will basically increase the resilience of the these economies. The World Bank also has a role, like I mentioned with this report that you referred to. They are a way also to back the loans. The way the bank works, we discussed, remember at the beginning, how the staff goes with the authorities and so on. But at the time I didn't mention, but usually this is part of a strategy. So you don't discuss a loan standalone. It has to be part of what's called the country strategy, where you look at all the aspects of the country and you take the priorities. So what the World Bank is doing now is to give an even more prominence of the climate aspects in these strategies, not the least because a climate, you see the extreme weather events and so on, climate, you have a bigger and bigger role in the economy of these countries, sometimes even in their ability to access certain markets, because certain markets are making restrictions for products that are not produced in a sustainable way. So I think that the World Bank is getting involved in all these aspects. It goes in industrial policy, it goes in agricultural practices, it goes, of course, everything that has to do with urban organization. And I think this is really, these are new frontiers for the bank, where it can use a lot what it has developed in all of these years, but put together in a different way. And here, if you give me 1 minute, we can discuss about the governance that is involved. So there have been a few discussions on how we strengthen the governance for climate views of both the IMF and the World Bank. And I think one place that already you see some of the discussion, but it could be even more prominent, is the highest governance, say, instance of the IMF, actually the common IMF World Bank. So it's of the World Bank, but also in a way of IMF, which is so-called Development Committee. They meet twice a year, and they're really totally strategic, and they define the big, say, lines of action of the World Bank. And I think that if we could empower the Development Committee to have this overview on the policies, climate policies, could be very helpful, and could also redirect some of the discussions about climate finance that I think this discussion have not yet found a perfect say focus. So this would be a very interesting place to have the discussion.
The Development Committee, just to remind our listeners, the IMF has a committee of governors at the finance minister level called the International Financial and Monetary Committee that makes lots of decisions that have to do with IMF strategies and priorities. And it's done at that high political level, and they meet twice a year, in the fall at the annual meetings and then the April spring meetings. But companion to that and created at the same time was the joint IMF-IBRD Development Committee, also at the governor's level. And I agree with you totally, Joachim, that the full potential of that committee really hasn't been developed, particularly as a joint committee. And we now have these global problems where, as you said, the G20 doesn't necessarily represent the entire membership of the institutions. So trying to give these bodies that are at meeting at sort of the political level, at the highest level, the finance ministers level, has really some great potential to moving cooperation forward. So like you, I'm convinced the Bretton Woods institutions are able and ready to play a crucial role in the transformations that the world's going through, and to set some priorities and really make some progress. So
I totally agree with you, and I think it's an exciting time and for doing that. And if you focus on the priorities and also select the actions that you have the biggest effect on people, on the climate, I think that the World Bank, the Bretton Woods institutions, will again raise to the challenge, like we mentioned when there was the fall of the Berlin Wall and a number of other occasions, right, and really help move the needle in a proportion actually that can be well beyond the size of its balance sheet, but commensurate to this appeal, this ability to bring people together, this long history of getting all the minds and the different countries really focused and keep this tradition of high levels of governance. So I think, it's, like you said, if with these new challenges, we might have to invent new institutions, would have been quite complicated at this point in time.
Right.
But I believe that with a little bit of effort and energy, the Bretton Woods could really help a lot in address this new existential global challenges and continue to help countries to strive to improve the livelihood of so many people.
As we have been speaking about the bank's role in helping its members address the economic and financial challenges posed by climate change and the broader issue of the bank's coordination with its sister institution, the IMF, I thought I'd highlight where the IMF sees its complementary role to the banks in addressing the economic impact of climate change. You mentioned, Joachim, the IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Trust. That's financed by loans from participating countries in order to provide a source of longer-term financing than is customary for IMF lending. The loans are 20-year maturity with a 10.5-year grace period are to members that will undertake reforms to reduce the risks of prospective balance of payments instability, particularly risks related to climate change and pandemic preparedness. We discussed the trust in our podcast on the IMF's role in low-income countries. In addition to this, the IMF will include in its Article 4 reviews of members' economies those aspects of climate change that can have a macroeconomic impact and will provide expanded technical assistance in areas where the IMF has specialized expertise. Together, the IMF and World Bank will factor the implications of climate change into their joint debt sustainability analyses of members. Well, this completes our three podcasts on the World Bank Group. Thank you, Joachim, for providing to us a sweeping overview of the group and how it serves as a as an important global cooperative institution to foster global development. As we've seen, the World Bank started as a lender for productive development projects in major sectors, such as power, communications, and utilities. It transitioned to a group of collaborative bodies to support all aspects of economic development challenges, from eliminating poverty to strengthening human or physical infrastructure, whether those challenges were unique to a particular country or involved a so-called public good, such as addressing global health or global environmental needs and crises. Moreover, the World Bank Group has played an important role in many ways in fostering private investment flows, functioning domestic financial markets, and stronger, more competent government institutions to help countries develop. Our next several podcasts will look at the regional development banks that are patterned to a large extent on the World Bank, and we'll look at the two newest MDBs. We'll see why each was created, how each has evolved in its activities, and how the MDBs relate to each other. Please join us on this journey. Meanwhile, do share these podcasts with those you think may be interested in and learn from them too. Thank you again, Joaquin.
Thank you so much.